Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome back. One more hour of Overnight America. I'm your host, Ryan Recker. A couple of things that, I send myself these notes over the course of a week and or a course of a day even, but it's over the course of a week because I was off for the past week, and I saw this one, and I thought, good for St. Louis to follow up on this. And KMOV did a story about fines for illegal dumping after surveillance continues to pick up. Now, there is a finder's fee. If you catch someone dumping trash, you can get $100 for that. And people have set up cameras just to catch people dumping so they can get that $100 every time it happens. Video, HD video proof of this. And some of the examples that KMOV use, it's pretty clear who it is. You see the person, you see the license plate, you see the car. Here's KMOV's story from the other day.
Owner posted on KMOV News 4's Facebook page video of her taking out the trash.
Everywhere you look, you see all this stuff out here.
The stuff the lady talks about comes from what she describes as illegal dumping.
It's become a junkyard. It looks like the Gunga Den in South Africa somewhere.
The city of St. Louis is taking note.
It does look pretty bad. I mean, when you go back and look at it, sure, it does look pretty terrible. In fact, I don't know anyone that would want that in their neighborhood. Just a bunch of ripped up, looks like cats just went crazy on these things, leather couches and things. It's not pretty. In fact, it's very ugly.
200 hidden surveillance cameras throughout the city. News 4 asked the mayor's office if the cameras are helpful. The mayor's spokesman sent images from those cameras capturing people in the act.
It's depressing. It's very depressing.
Pat Miller has lived in St. Louis more than 70 years.
Illegal dumping takes away our pride in the neighborhood. It's something that seems like it's uncontrollable.
Yes, because it is. It does take out the pride in the neighborhood. And yes, it's absolutely frustrating. Totally worth the investment if you can get a camera out there. If she lives in that area and she can get a camera to prove who's coming in and dumping these things, it's well worth her money. Why? Because there is money in it.
She tells News 4 people illegally dump trash outside her North City door every week.
We that live in North St. Louis have learned to accept it. It comes with our neighborhood. It's just a reality that we have to deal with.
The city insists Miller and her neighbors don't. So far this year, the city has cited 418 people for illegal dumping.
Good.
That's up from fewer than 300 last year.
Good.
The accused violators have been fined $72,000.
Good.
Which is $12,000 more in fines than last year.
Awesome. Awesome, awesome, awesome. More of that. I'd love to see that trend continue. Catch him dumping trash. And yes, that is unacceptable. You live in a neighborhood and people come dumping trash in the back alleyways and things. Unacceptable. So good for them to take up on that. You know, she's not the only one that's got some issues. In Kansas City, a woman's pretty angry about her property taxes going up. This is Fox 4 in Kansas City. She found a pretty unique way to fight back.
Frustration continues to boil over on the ongoing property tax debacle in Jackson County.
It's everywhere. Everywhere people are complaining about their property taxes going up. This is just another one of these really lousy, cheap ways the city will go out there and, oh, they're going to keep raising your property value so they can collect more taxes from you. It's just more ways to collect. And you look at these things and you say, how in the world are they assessing my property this way? And you're thinking, there's no way I can sell my property for this. They know the only reason they're upping it is because that it can collect some more dough.
Bill Lockett has lived in the Hyde Park Midtown area of KCMO for over 30 years, opening her 2019 property tax bill.
Can I do a Fred Sanford?
Finding her land value increasing by 135% and her overall market value is up 45% over 2018.
Yikes.
I'm fussing, but I'm not impacted nearly as bad as a lot of my Hyde Park Midtown neighbors. I mean, there were people who got 300% and 400% increases in a year. Are you kidding?
Yeah, seriously. How can they justify that the price raises or the value of the location raises 300 to 400% overnight? You know, you can't. You can't because it's not realistic. And it's really not what the market would dictate for something like that. So you know what she said? She's like, fine, I understand. I can't do much about it. I understand I'm going to have to do this. So what does she do? She contacts her bank and she orders 1,419 rolls of nickels. Weighs over 625 pounds. She's going to go hand deliver that to pay her bill in rolled nickels from her bank. Good for her. Now, I can't wait to see the video of her rolling in there. And she's made such a public spectacle of this. And she said that, you know, it needs to be a public spectacle. They need to understand what they're doing is totally inappropriate and lousy. So let's stop this. So she's making a big deal about it. And yes, she went to the media first. She's getting reports on it first. Why? So when they roll up, it's not a surprise and they know, hey, ball's in your court. Are you going to accept my payment or not? Puts the city in a bad position. What are they going to do? Not accept her money? So that's going to be happening here soon. That's a lot of nickels. You know, in a couple hours ago, we had an interview with Rich Rubino. I wanted to play that back. Rich Rubino does a great, great segment with us on Monday nights. American Politics on the Rocks is the name of his book. You can look him up online. We want to look at some of the things that could be happening in the Democratic Party as they still have a lot of people declared. And then Bloomberg hops in there. What will happen if, for example, they go to their convention and they don't have enough delegates? Not one person has enough delegates to become the party nominee. Well, that looks like it's going to happen if Bloomberg has his way. Richard Bino talks about that strategy coming up on Overnight America KMOX. And joining us now is the author of American Politics on the Rocks. We check in with him on Mondays on Overnight America. Rich Rubino, thanks for coming on.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me again.
It's good to have you back. The last week was a little bit weird, so I hope you had a great Thanksgiving. I enjoyed mine. So I wanted to talk about what's going on with the races. Thanksgiving week's kind of a lull. I don't know if a lot of people pay attention to politics Thanksgiving week. I think most are concerned about their families or purposely not paying attention to politics. And I'm wondering, in your household, are there any political debates that come onto the table Thanksgiving Day?
No, not really. Not really.
That's probably for the best.
It's interesting. I hear so many people say, you know, how do we get through these Thanksgiving with the relatives and how do we get through? I always say, well, it's pretty simple. Just don't talk about politics.
Yeah.
Talk about anything else. It's not that complicated. There are so many other subjects. Talk about aluminum siding.
Aluminum siding. Do you know a lot about aluminum siding?
Well, I guess you could go to Wikipedia beforehand, and then as soon as someone talks about politics, bring up aluminum siding and try to change the subject. Just try to divert it to something else, unless you want to have an educated political discussion. But I know a lot of people don't want to be, you know, don't want to go through kind of a divisive Thanksgiving, particularly if you're having it with somebody you're only going to see once or twice a year.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's fascinating, though, if you just go on the Internet and go on so many Facebook posts. You know, it's fascinating how many people seem to enjoy debating politics with strangers.
Yep. Well, over the past week, has there been much that's changed in the political race for the 2020 presidency?
A little bit. What seems to be going on right now is, so Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, who's worth about $52 billion, dollars, he's declared that he's going to run, and he has an interesting strategy in that he's going to essentially skip the first four states.
Ooh.
So conventional thinking is that the way you win, you go to Iowa, then New Hampshire, then you go to Nevada, then you go to South Carolina. In terms of contemporaneously, what happened, the reason that strategy, kind of the small state strategy, people will look at Jimmy Carter, for example, in 1976, former one-term governor of Georgia, had a lot of formidable opponents, Frank Harris from Oklahoma, Senator Scoop Jackson from Washington, Jerry Brown, the current governor at the time of California. So Jimmy Carter spends an enormous amount of time in Iowa, and he really does it, you know, with himself just out there with handing out brochures, and he had his peanut brigade, Polk from Georgia, going off campaigning, and he wins Iowa, then he goes on to win New Hampshire. Eventually, he becomes immutable. There's a movement to try to stop him with Jerry Brown and then Frank Church of Idaho, but he goes on to win the nomination. Mm-hmm. So the conventional thinking is that that's how you win. You do all this retail politicking. That's not really Mike Bloomberg's style. The only office he's ever won is mayor of New York City, which is you know, obviously the largest city in the country. So he's not necessarily going to do the strategy of going to Iowa and going to town halls. Like, you know, for example, Amy Klobuchar is going to go to all 99 counties in Iowa. Hmm. He's going to skip all those, wait till March 3rd when you have a lot of super delegate states like California, Massachusetts, Vermont, and he's going to try to win there. And it's not necessarily going to be these, you know, going to a coffee shop, having town halls. A lot of it's just going to be he's going to blanket the airwaves in a lot of these states. And it's an interesting strategy. It's more wholesale than retail. And it really, which is what happens essentially in a general election. You know, you don't have the candidates spending a lot of time, for example, in Iowa and New Hampshire, meeting with individual voters. They spend a lot of their time going from tarmac to tarmac to tarmac. And that's what I think a lot of what Bloomberg's going to try to do. So it's an interesting strategy.
Yeah, it is. Considering when we look back at 2016, one of the criticisms they had of Hillary Clinton was that she kind of skipped a lot of these different areas, right? She kind of went around during her presidency, and that ended up hurting her. You know, she wasn't really as present as a normal candidate would. So what's the advantages of that? Why would Michael Bloomberg look at what happened in 2016 and think that perhaps this would be a strategy to repeat and he would be more successful doing it?
Well, with Hillary, it was more in the general election. She competed in the primaries against Bernie Sanders, and the general election is where she essentially ignored the state of Wisconsin, never even made a visit there, and ended up losing by 23,000 votes. She was spending time in places like Arizona where she thought she could siphon off from Donald Trump, from the Republicans, but because of the influx of Latino voters, but she wasn't able to do that. There have been some precedent for this strategy in the past. The one that comes to mind is Al Gore, 1988, not 2000, but 1988. He was 40 years old, and essentially he said at the time that he didn't like the arcane rules of Iowa, so he skipped Iowa, spent very little time in New Hampshire, waited to go to Super Tuesday, and then on Super Tuesday he actually won about seven states. He was the last really Southern Democrat that ran as a Southern Democrat, very popular with white Southerners. He won Tennessee, Arkansas, Alabama, Mississippi, a lot of those states. But he wasn't really necessarily able to translate it to the next elections. Eventually, he went to New York, and he was endorsed by the mayor of New York City, Ed Koch, but he lost it. And the other issue that Al Gore had was some of the southern states actually split with Jesse Jackson, because Jesse Jackson was able to siphon off a lot of the states that had particularly African-American supporters. So it didn't work for Al Gore. 2000, he runs again for president. He campaigns vociferously in Iowa, New Hampshire, wins both, goes on to beat Bill Bradley in just about every contest. 2004, Wesley Clark skipped Iowa. Joe Lieberman originally started campaigning in Iowa, then decided his strategy was going to change. He was going to spend most of his time in New Hampshire instead. So as a result, he didn't participate in the caucuses, went on to campaign in New Hampshire, never really did very well in any of the primaries, ended up dropping out. So there really isn't much precedent for somebody just not really campaigning in those few states and then hoping that they could win in a more wholesale type of a campaign. But I think what Michael Bloomberg is doing, though, is he's figuring, you know, I have a lot of money, and he's figuring I can do something that's kind of unprecedented, if you will. And part of that is going to be a lot of these states have open primaries. Mm-hmm. So meaning that they can have independents can vote in Democratic presidential elections. So he could potentially say that he thinks that he's going to win some centrists, some independents, maybe even some Republicans who become independents to vote for him in some of those primaries. But it's a really risky strategy. But when you have, you know, $50 billion, I guess you might as well try it.
That's all, only $50 billion only?
Well, I guess if you're Bill Gates or Warren Buffett, it's only $50 billion. It's all relative.
Yeah.
For the average person, $50 billion is probably a lot of money. And, you know, it's going to be a big question is going to be, you know, how much support does that translate? I mean, Tom Steyer is also a billionaire. It's only about a 2-3% in the polls, and he's, you know, spending an inordinate amount of money, but it hasn't necessarily translated to votes for him yet. And there have been examples, by the way, of billionaires who have run races. Michael Huntington in California, for example, who ran for Senate race and don't necessarily do very well, despite the fact that they're spending that much money. So you do it does have to translate into, you know, likability. It has to translate into actually having a message that strikes a resonant chord with the electorate. Just the fact that you have a lot of money is certainly not tantamount to a victory.
Yeah, he's no Ross Perot or, in this case, Donald Trump, even, if you want to talk about someone that comes in.
Yeah, that's
and
somebody
about
who
money.
was able to use his fortune and was able to win a race that only Michael Moore and Ann Coulter thought he could win.
Rich Rubino, the book American Politics on the Rocks, which you can find on Amazon. Again, what's the website if they wanted to check out your blog?
Just go to www.polita-geek.com.
I want to talk to you about the No Malarkey bus tour in general.
Oh, yes.
I like it when politicians go out on the road and they got the big branded bus. And I want to talk to you about what could potentially happen convention time if there's not enough delegates that could agree who should be their nominee, because it's an interesting brokered convention. We'll talk to our friend Rich Rubino coming up next on Overnight America KMOX. Joining us again, our friend Rich Rubino. Every Monday, you can check him out on Overnight America here in his book, American Politics on the Rocks. You can get on Amazon. You can also look him up online. Rich Rubino, thank you again for sticking around. I keep seeing the Joe Bidens of the world out on tour, and I see him doing speeches. You know, they set up the temporary podiums in the stages, and he goes up and he says a few words, and he's got the big branded bus in the background. It's the branded No Malarkey bus tour.
Yeah.
So politicians hitting the road via bus. Do you think that is one of those just obligatory things that'll happen to pretty much every campaign at some point?
Oh, absolutely. One thing it does is I think it humanizes the candidate. One issue that Joe Biden, he's been in public life since 1972. He's been vice president for 8 years, and, you know, where he had Secret Service around him. It's actually an opportunity for him to do, we're talking about what Michael Bloomberg won't be able to do in terms of retail politics. It's able for him to go to Iowa, go into small crowds, meet people, and people actually see him as somebody other than somebody that's kind of, you know, somebody that you kind of look to, almost genuflect to, because it's the office that he holds. In many respects, it does humanize him, but it also is also the risk that he has. You know, every time, everybody that you meet, someone's going to ask some off-the-wall question or something to that effect, and he's going to go off on some sort of a tangent, and then all of a sudden it's going to be the next day that's all people are going to talk about. So that's one of the fears that you have when you do that, but it definitely is something that he needs to do. It's his way of showing that he's not going to take Iowa and retail politicking for granted, that he's going to go to these places. Amy Klobuchar, by the way, is going to go to all 99 counties, believe it or not. And that's why I think that she's somebody who potentially could be a wild card here in terms of finishing very well in Iowa, because she's going to all the places that the other candidates aren't going to. She's going to extremely rural parts of the state. Now, the problem with that is there aren't that many people there. But if you can win enough caucus goers to actually come out and support you, like John Edwards did in 2004, for example, she could be a surprise there.
You know, it's funny, I've seen a couple of the things pop up on Twitter. One, Joe Biden nibbling on a woman's finger.
Yes.
Do they actually ride the bus? Because we had this controversy here in Missouri back when there was the Senate race between Josh Hawley and Claire McCaskill, who was the incumbent. And she had the bus and she was going to go all across Missouri. But, you know, she wanted to sound more rural, so she started calling it Missouri just for the election campaign. But, you know, there's all the videos of her hopping on her private jet while the bus was driving around. So she wasn't on this thing. Is Joe Biden actually, do politicians actually ride on these buses?
Yes, they do, actually. They do, actually. And some of them, I mean, John McCain, part of the reason in 2000 he really came out from the political abyss to actually beat George W. Bush in New Hampshire is he did what was called the Straight Talk Express. So what he would do is while they were going from municipality to municipality, he would sit there and essentially reporters would be able to ask him any question they wanted. So you're actually doing stuff while you're on the bus. You're not just sitting there in a dark bus waiting to get from point A to point B. You're actually lots of times you're talking to reporters, you're doing interviews, you're calling up benefactors saying, you know, can I have a little bit more money, that type of thing. So it's almost like a working office.
Yeah, in a bathroom.
there was an acting governor from Massachusetts named Jane Swift who lived on the opposite side of the state. And she would literally travel 2.5 hours from one side to the other every day with a trooper essentially driving a Jeep going back one way from the other. And later I said, why do you do this? And she said, well, she gets a lot of work done while sitting in the back of the SUV.
Wow, that is not efficient.
The commute from hell, I would say.
Yeah, no kidding. Rich Rubino joins us here on Overnight America. And outside of some of the different things you're seeing right now, tactics that some of the politicians are using, I don't think anyone's dropped out in the past 2 weeks.
They have actually today. Actually, yesterday. You had, first of all, Joe Sestak, and I know you're going to say who. he was a former, an admiral, one of the most decorated people ever to serve in the House of Representatives. He was elected in 2006, served two terms. made the not sagacious decision in 2010. He decides he's going to run for a Senate seat, beats Arlen Specter in the primary, then loses to Pat Toomey in the general election, then runs again and loses. So he's a two-time loser in Pennsylvania. He decides he's going to run for president. No one in the media takes him seriously. He never registers 1% in the polls. He dropped out. But the more formidable candidate was actually Montana Governor Steve Bullock, who was somebody who actually was reelected as governor of Montana in 2016 by 4 points, the same day where Donald Trump was elected, won the state with 20 points, by 20 points, and Steve Bullock won about 25% of Trump supporters. So that was his argument. That was his argument, was that essentially, you elect me, I can win Republican voters. He got into one debate. He did relatively well in another debate. In that debate, and people were talking about him potentially as a moderate alternative should Joe Biden falter. But after that, he was never able to garner enough support to get into any future debates. So he dropped out, and now Montana Democrats are absolutely beseeching him to run against Steve Daines, who's the incumbent senator. He keeps saying that he's not going to do it. There's going to be a lot of pressure put upon him because he has probably 99% name recognition in the state. He's got job approval ratings about 60%, so he may be the only one who could actually defeat him. The question is, could Chuck Schumer, the House, the Senate minority leader, if they get the majority, could he potentially award him some sort of a chairmanship or give him some sort of a prize to get him in? He seems very reluctant to want to be one of 100 senators, but he could be the only person who could potentially win that seat and maybe potentially give the Senate to the Democrats.
Oh, interesting. So let's say we continue to see the very busy and the very crowded field of Democrats that want their party's nomination. And let's say the Bloombergs of the world, they start to succeed, and perhaps he may be getting to the point where there's a brokered convention.
Yeah,
can you explain that process of what happens if there's not one person that has enough delegates to vote for them to become their nominee?
So at least in the Democratic Party, you need almost 2,000 delegates to be declared the winner. So you can do this in terms of it. Actually, the delegates are actually counted at the convention. You win them in the primaries, and they're also superdelegates. There's a bunch of pledge electors. It's a whole mathematical formula. But basically, at the convention, there's going to be a roll call, and most of the states will say, we award, it's going to be, say, Vermont, then they say the great state, the Green Mountain State, and they say, we award our votes to the next president of the United States, and everyone cheers, and it's usually universal. There may be a few recalcitrant folks who vote for the person they voted support in the primary. But basically, it's a preordained who's going to get the nomination. I mean, last time, in 2016, for example, Hillary Clinton had won in the primary. She had enough delegates. Everyone knew she was going to get the nomination. Superdelegates, essentially a lot of them who supported Bernie Sanders, landed up supporting her as well. Some actually didn't. There were some recalcitrant folks. But basically, there's a certain number that you have. And if you don't reach that number, what happens is they do another vote. And if you go back to 1924, in 1924, there was actually, in the Democratic side, there was 103 separate ballots before John W. Davis, who no one had ever heard of, landed up winning the nomination. The front runner that year was William McAdoo, the former Treasury Secretary in the Wilson administration. He didn't get enough delegates, just kept going on and on and on for about a week, and finally it came down to the point where the convention chose the person that they had never heard of, ends up losing in a landslide to Calvin Coolidge. The last time there were brokered conventions, by the way, was 1952. In the Republican side, it was Eisenhower against Robert Taft, the son of William Howard Taft, who was a senator from Ohio, nicknamed Mr. Republican. Eisenhower ended up garnering the nomination at the convention and ended up going on to winning the presidency. Also that year, the Democratic side, interestingly, because this was Harry Truman did not seek reelection, and you had Adlai Stevenson, the governor of Illinois, who was not running for president. He was running for reelection as governor of Illinois, and the convention that year was in Chicago, so he gave an address welcoming the delegates. Harry Truman wanted him to be the nominee. There was pressure on him to put his tool after the first ballot, and they did not get a nominee. One of those, Alvin Barkley, was the vice president, but there were a lot of union leaders that said they weren't going to support him. So eventually, Stevenson says, "Okay, you can let me be the run for president." They can let me put my name into nomination. He does, and he ends up getting the nomination. The only thing, similarly, 1880, James Garfield was there as a member of the Ohio delegation nominating James Sherman for president, and people liked what he said. They started yelling, "We want Garfield, we want Garfield." After a few more disputed ballots, they just put despite the fact he never wanted the nomination, wasn't there, Garfield ends up getting the nomination. Now, this has come close a couple times, but it hasn't happened since then. 68, Humphrey landed up winning at the convention. 1976, there was Gerald Ford ended up beating Ronald Reagan by the hair of his chinny-chin-chin by winning Mississippi, winning just a few more delegates to win the nomination. And then in 1980, you had Jimmy Carter and Ted Kennedy, and Jimmy Carter was able to win the nomination before it went to the ballot. But it was an extremely close election. So that's essentially what happens. It really needed a perfect storm against the process for this to happen. And the Democratic side, there are 3,976 pledged delegates. You need about 1,990 in order to win the nomination. So the possibility is, let's say in Iowa, let's say Pete Buttigieg wins. Uh-huh. Then you go to New Hampshire, let's say Elizabeth Warren wins. Then you go to Nevada, let's say in Nevada Bernie Sanders wins. Then you go to South Carolina, and then Joe Biden wins. So essentially, there's very little traction from those first few states. Then you go to Super Tuesday on March 3rd, and let's say Bloomberg cleans up with a bunch of states, and you keep going on, all five candidates keep going on and on and on. They don't reach that threshold. Then you go to convention, and then you have a brokered convention.
Mm-hmm. That's complicated, but it makes
for good,
I guess, news networks are salivating at the idea of something like this happening right now.
It happens, by the way, sometimes it'll happen at the state level. There might be a state convention, and then some states might have, for example, in some states you need 15% of the delegates in order to get your name on the ballot. So sometimes there'll be brokered conventions, and maybe one candidate will say, I'll give you some of my delegates in order to get on there if you do something. So it happens more at the state level, but it doesn't happen since 1952 at the presidential level.
Yeah. Rich Rubino joining us here on Overnight America. One last question for you.
Yes.
With all the candidates they're going around, why do they all like to go to diners and ice cream shops? That's the only two places they stop at when they go into these small areas, and they love it when the cameras are there.
Yeah, that's Joe Biden. Joe Biden's forte, in many respects, is doing that. I think lots of times they set it up beforehand, so they walk in there, and it's usually they get people that are kind of off guard. They're saying, what's going on here? And it actually can be awkward for candidates that aren't very good at small talk. Because, you go up there and it seems very awkward. Someone's got a Baltimore Orioles hat. You go, oh, how are the Orioles doing? Or something to that effect.
Uh-huh.
And when you're watching some of this stuff on TV, you watch C-SPAN for an hour or so, you can see that the candidates are very uncomfortable. The line that usually they like to say is they'll say something like, oh, hi, how are you? Nice to see you. Thank you for being here. The problem is sometimes people want to talk to them longer and longer.
Yeah, of course.
I remember John Kerry, in 2003 was in New Hampshire, and he was in a diner. And he stopped by, and a guy came, and so we actually sat down with the guy. The guy said, I have a question for you. And John, I remember watching this on C-SPAN, and John Kerry said, oh, yes. And then he's hoping it's going to be a policy question. The guy says, how do you get your hair like that? And then John Kerry says, oh, I have a good barber, ha ha, kept laughing. And the guy just keeps going on and on and on about John Kerry's hair, and all the media is filming him doing that. Another instance that I thought was fascinating was Mitt Romney was going into in a diner, and so there was a World War II veteran, and he had a hat on, and he walked over to him, and the guy said he had a question, and he thinks it's going to be something about veterans issues, something like that. So Romney looks at him, and then the guy says, I got a question for you. He says, what's your position on gay marriage? And then Romney says, oh, I'm against that. And then the guy says, well, let me ask you something. What difference does it make? And then Mitt Romney just looked very uncomfortable, and he just kind of looks, and then he kind of just walks away. But he could tell it was a position that he didn't want to do.
Yeah.
The place he was saying, just get me out of here. John Edwards actually, I think, had the best strategy when he ran for Senate in 1998 in North Carolina. He did what's called beach tours. And this is where I think the people probably most relax is at the beach. So he would go all around beaches in North Carolina with people having signs, Edwards for Senate, and he'd walk around and meet people. And people are generally in very good moods. That's why I always say that when you're doing this signature process, when you have to get a bunch of signatures basically to get somebody's name on the ballot, the worst place to do it is probably during the day in a major city when everyone's going to work and they're in a bad mood, or if they're going onto the subway. The last thing they want to do is sign papers for somebody running for office. Mm-hmm. But if you're in a beach, or for that matter, if you go into diners where people are in a little more relaxed mood, and you go, oh, can you sign this for somebody, then people might be more willing to sign it, I think.
It's a great tip. Excellent tip for anyone that may be listening right now.
If you're ever getting signatures, Go to any place where people are relaxed and more likely to do it. Never go in the middle of the day when people are on the subway going to work because they're probably in a lousy mood. And the last thing they want to do is sign papers for some guy they never heard of running for cemetery commissioner.
Yep. Rich Rubino. Again, if people wanted to look you up online, where can they find you?
Yep. Just go to www.polita-geek.com or just find me on Facebook, too. Rich Rubino.
And the book, American Politics on the Rocks, our Monday conversation. Thank you so much for coming on to Overnight America.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
He joins us on the Quiver River Electric KMOX guest line.
And by the way, you know, I sit on the stand and it get hot. I got hairy legs that turn blonde in the sun. And the kids used to come up and reach in the pool and rub my leg down so it was straight and then watch the hair come back up again. They look at it. So I learned about roaches. I learned about kids jumping on my lap. And I've loved kids jumping on my lap. And I tell you what.
Oh, boy. What in the world were you saying there, Joe Biden? What were you getting to? The world may never, ever know. I'm your host, Ryan Recker. You can follow me on Twitter at Ryan Recker. And if you miss any part of the show, you can download the podcast at KMOX.com/ONA. Make it your favorite podcast. Leave a nice review. That would definitely go a long way. I had a fun Thanksgiving week. I enjoyed the last, you know, week off. Ate a lot on Thursday. Spent a lot of time traveling. So I'm looking forward to my time off for Christmas even more now, because I'm not going anywhere. I don't have to waste 2 days in the car, you know, day driving down and a day driving back. Feels like there's so much I could have been doing. And I have to figure out what I'm going to be doing in that time, mostly because if you don't plan it out ahead of time, then you just feel like it is mostly wasted in general. You know, I had to go back into the archive and I found a commentary that I thought was just great. It was back in 2002, Andy Rooney, talking about what we're experiencing right now, with the top story being Cyber Monday. Let's look at CBS in 2020 or no, 60 Minutes.
One of the ways we divide our year is with holidays. The 4th of July is the beginning of summer. Labor Day is the beginning of the new year. New Year's Day isn't really the beginning of anything except a new calendar. Thanksgiving is our most American holiday, and it's good because we don't have to do anything on Thanksgiving except maybe eat turkey and watch football. That's why I object to the way it's being squeezed out by Christmas. The trouble is, there's no money in Thanksgiving for businesses. People trying to sell things want to skip right over it and get to Christmas. Christmas is far and away the most commercial holiday we have. Some stores do 30% of their whole year's business in the period before Christmas. That's why they try to make it last a long time by starting it earlier every year. Here it is, 4 days before Thanksgiving, and the stores are already all about Christmas. The big department stores have their Christmas windows fixed up. They're good to look at, but they're too soon, that's all. It ought to be against the law to start Christmas before December. In the malls, some stores have had their Christmas decorations up since October. Kids are sitting on Santa Claus's lap telling him what they want before their parents know where they're going to get the money to pay for it. In New York City, they put up the tree in Rockefeller Center 10 days ago, 41 days before Christmas. The Salvation Army already has its bell ringers on the streets looking for Christmas donations. Everyone is trying to make whatever it has to sell at this time of year seem like a Christmas present. Shoes are not a Christmas present at any time of year. On television, they're unlikely Christmas gifts. How'd you like a bottle of Pepto-Bismol for Christmas? For the past 6 weeks, we've been getting magazines with special Christmas or holiday subscription offers. When you open a magazine, these holiday flyers fall out like confetti. In advertising, holiday is the new religiously correct name for Christmas. I like Christmas presents, Christmas music, Christmas trees, Christmas cards. I like the Christmas spirit. What I don't like is the way people whose only interest in Christmas is money have moved in on a nice non-commercial holiday like Thanksgiving.
Way to go, Andy Rooney. He had some very fine commentaries over the years. That was back in 2002. That about does it for us. We'll be back again tomorrow. Don't forget, you can listen anytime you please on your smartphone. Just open up your podcast app. There's one built right into it for you to enjoy. Just search Overnight America, and then you'll see a picture of my face.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.